Blog Talk Radio.
This is from Kelly, Kelly, Kelly Manjaro, Tanzania. Como eu posso hit the normal people here, man? It's gonna go everywhere in Africa. Why, see, I'm gonna tell you about Como eu posso.
You wanna hear about what I wanna tell about? Nataka kufikia, nachotaka kuongea. Como eu posso, homo, homo, eu posso.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. From time to time, we will have a special presentation on a variety of topics. Homeopathy is a show hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brooks. Please contact HWC if you would like to help support the show as a sustaining member or have suggestions for future shows. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your questions. Please share by tweeting on Twitter, posting on Facebook and MySpace, and all other social networks. You may select the widget and place the player on your blog or website. With gratitude to all our listeners, let's go!
Hello, this is Debbie Brock, and today is May 27th, 2013. In the USA, it is Memorial Day or Veterans Day. We are celebrating those who have given their lives for freedom, really, and we are talking about freedom of information here on Blog Talk Radio and also on the Health In Show, which broadcasts each Monday as an affiliate program of Homeopathy World Community. We're going to be waiting for Dr. Isaac Golden to call in on the line and speak with us. And ask your friends to join us. I just opened the chat so you can go in there. So Dr. Golden has been speaking to us over a number of programs about the vaccine issues, about homeoprophylaxis, and about getting information out and responding to people who are detractors of homeopathy or complementary and alternative medicine. He provides his patients with homeoprophylaxis for infectious disease. This is based on decades of study. This really is being used around the globe in so many numbers, and thousands of people have been using homeopathy to prevent an outbreak, an epidemic of infectious disease. And there's a lot of information on the internet to find that. Or you can go to Homeopathy World Community and just put it in the search for Dr. Isaac Golden. So we're going to go ahead and talk about something a little bit different, which is evidence-based medicine. And why we're talking about it today is because of numerous articles that have recently been posted on major networks. And in those cases, we want to know how to respond or whether it is worth responding. And I see he's been able to call in, so we're going to welcome Dr. Golden to the line today, and I appreciate all of your efforts in keeping up with Homeopathy World Community at these odd hours of the night for you. So are you able to hear us at this time?
I can hear you, Debbie. Can you hear me?
Very clearly, like you're right here with me. So that's great.
That's
we just
great.
Did a quick little introduction. I think there might be like a slight delay, so go ahead and speak.
Right. Now, I was just saying I've been madly pressing buttons for the last minute and finally must have pressed the right one, so that's lovely.
Okay, you're in. It's a little blue Skype button for anyone out there who is listening and tuning into Blog Talk Radio today. There is a chat window open, so register or put your name in and ask your questions right there. Put your comments in. We're going to be talking about this issue of evidence-based medicine and why detractors would want to say something like homeopathy or homeopathic medicine contains poison as a major headline. Is that a scare tactic? Why would people say such a thing and keep harping on it and saying that homeopathy kills? They actually do say such a thing when the evidence for that is totally missing, and the amount of death and side effects and harm that is done by allopathic or regular conventional medicine is so perverse. It's out there. The numbers are there. Who is reading this? Who is listening? Do the majority of people know about this? So we're listening to whatever you want to contribute today.
So, Debbie, can I start off? And I don't want this to end up sounding too much like a formal lecture, but I'd really love to start off by citing an article which has only recently just been published. And one of the authors is my favourite orthodox author when it comes to research, Professor John Ioannidis. And for folks who would like to follow this up after the talk, his surname is spelt Ioannidis. And John P.A. Ioannidis. And anything that he writes, I find to be really excellent. He's a doctor, he's a mathematician, he's an epidemiologist. And back in 2005, he wrote quite a remarkable article, Why Most Research Findings Are False. And it was one of the most compelling looks at orthodox research. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that in a while. But he and a couple of colleagues have just released a new article. And I think it actually answers the question that you just posed. Why are attacks like the ones you just described, why are they happening? Now, the title of the article, and don't bother having to write everything down for those who want to follow it. If you search Ioannidis 2013, you'll almost certainly come across it. But the title says, Undue Industry Influences That Distort Healthcare Research, Strategy, Expenditure and Practice, a Review. And it was published in the European Journal of Clinical Investigation. And by the way, this is a guy who's no fan of complementary medicine. He certainly believes that the evidence base of complementary medicine is lacking, just as he believes the evidence base of orthodox medicine is lacking. But I'll just read the conclusion that's in the abstract, and I think it'll give a pretty good answer by an orthodox person who's a leader, international leader in his field, to the question you just asked. And he says, to serve its interests, the industry masterfully influences evidence-based production, evidence synthesis, understanding of harms issues, cost-effectiveness evaluations, clinical practice guidelines, and healthcare professional education, and also exerts direct influences on professional decisions and health consumers. There is an urgent need for regulation and other action towards redefining the mission of medicine towards a more objective and patient population and society benefit direction that is free from conflict of interests. And in the article, he and his colleagues go through every aspect of what he just mentioned there, right from the education of orthodox medical practitioners through to research findings, the information which doctors are given not only at college but once they get out into practice, and the sort of bias that really does have a huge influence on the way that orthodox medicine is practiced. Now, we know that Orthodox Big Pharma spend about $40 billion a year in America alone just on promotion, buying influence, advertising, etc. It's a massive amount of money. Unfortunately, one doesn't want to indulge in any conspiracy theories, but when you get Orthodox people highlighting this issue, I think that's where the answer lies. Over to you.
So we have a problem with conflict of interest. We have a problem with the amount of funds that are spent in promoting Orthodox medicine as the answer to people's problems and promoting it as such, where the big industry, they're going to be the profit makers. And it's a problem. I really do feel it's a problem that they're able to bribe and pay off our government agencies that are supposed to supervise the safety of medicine and the safety of the practice of medicine. And instead, it's more like they dictate. So I know that physicians, they go into to their clinic or their hospital, and they would like to practice medicine by making a self-determination of whether somebody, what kind of treatment, what kind of lab works they need. And instead, they are forced into this narrow direction of they must do something to protect themselves against being sued, or because industry, medical industry requires it of them, and it's actually creating a poverty of the. Very, very harsh words against what's happening to the people who are suffering with illness. Is this all part of it?
Yeah, I mean it's so interesting to look at a community. Which is not dominated by Big Pharma. And I had an email a few days ago from Dr. Bracho in Cuba, and we've talked about him before in our previous discussions when we've talked about the evidence base of homeoprophylaxis, because the work that he and his colleagues are doing in Cuba has contributed enormously to the evidence base of homeoprophylaxis, remembering, of course, that these people, Dr. Bracho is not a homeopath. He's an international expert on vaccine adjuvants. And in his email a few days ago, he told me that in Cuba now, pharmacies are being directed to stock homeopathic medicines as part of the mainstream system of health there. And what this is showing is that they've found through practical use, which is devoid of vested interest, because, of course, the profit motive is not a factor there. They've found that homeopathic medicines are not only effective for prevention, but also extremely effective for treatment. They've found that they're free of side effects. And whilst people may get aggravations at times, these are not toxic aggravations, they're energetic disturbances. And they've also found that homeopathic medicine is very, very cost effective in terms of economics. I mean, I think we worked out that the homeoprophylaxis costs are about 1/20th, for example, of vaccine costs, and treatment remedies are, once again, just a fraction of what orthodox pharmaceuticals, even those made by the Cubans themselves. We can see what the effect is when there's a level playing field, when there are no financial vested interests. Now, I know a lot of people, a lot of skeptics, for example, will say, here we go again, it's people in complementary medicine bagging Big Pharma, they're always the bogeyman, and, you know, it's just their excuse for not producing evidence. And that's what our topic is tonight, the quality of evidence. But The reason I wanted to start with Professor Ioannidis' article, to quote, is to show actually that the evidence base of orthodox medicine is, to a large extent, not a lot better than the evidence base of complementary medicine, including homeopathy. And once this is realised, you can put a lot of the criticisms of homeopathy in context. The problem, the next problem is, of course, that because Big Pharma pays millions in my country and in your country billions of dollars to the mainstream media for advertising, that means the message is not getting across to most people. It's only people who choose to inform themselves, and that would include probably most of the people listening to the show tonight, who actually have an inkling that there is a lot of evidence out there for complementary medicine, including homeopathy, and that there are problems with the what we're being told. And I just keep coming back to the fact that when you see an orthodox expert, and a world-acknowledged, one of the most sought-after speakers on the orthodox medical circuit, saying things like he has said, and he backs it up with evidence, then it's a game changer if people could only just get to know about it. Over to you.
Right. So there are all different aspects to this issue. One, the majority of people are getting a propaganda message, basically, something that is bought and paid for, telling them that, for instance, the Angelina Jolie issue, that everybody, every woman needs to be tested for this BRCA gene for tendency or susceptibility to have breast cancer and then remove part of their body if they do. And that's a problem because only a very small percentage, I think it's either 1% or 5%, will be affected in this way, that the majority of women who have cancer, they don't have that gene. So who stands to gain by every single person getting this very expensive test? That's one of the things. So lab tests are very expensive for everybody, and if this is how they consider preventative medicine, it's not really true. They're not promoting things like better lifestyle, better nutrition, better diet, relaxation, the myriad of alternative practices that can really put a person in a better state of health by reducing stress. So that is one of the things. And the other things about getting this message out is, you're saying we're preaching to the choir kind of thing. The people who are tuning in today and are listening are the people who are already tuned into the message. They want to hear more of it, but we're all the majority of people who are not getting the message. That's our responsibility, to talk to neighbors, to have little gatherings, whether it's a tea or a luncheon or just going to your library. This is something that you need to talk to other people to open their eyes. The problem is that most people, when they hit up against somebody who is adamantly pro all of their physician, who they have to trust. I mean, you put your faith and trust in your doctor to take care of you and keep you well. And if they're telling you need a flu shot every year, then that's what you're going to believe. And it's hard to open up to other people. Is this something an issue part of this equation?
Yeah, it is very difficult. I mean, look, I personally believe that most physicians, most orthodox GPs, are decent, caring people who are more worried about their patients' welfare than purely crass things like their bank balance, although everyone needs to think about that, and that's not inappropriate. But unfortunately, physicians are fed the information as well, and that's what one of the points that Ioannidis was making in this latest article that the influence on medical education, beginning right from year one in Orthodox Medical College, it distorts a person's view. So it takes a brave doctor to actually be prepared to think outside of the Orthodox box. Now, we're talking here about how medicine's practiced in Western countries, in South American countries, in some European countries that are from the old Eastern Bloc, and even in some of the more Western European countries, we find that the knowledge base of physicians is broader. But I know in Australia, for example, and Australia has followed the American medical model very closely rather than the European one, that the knowledge base of even the best intentioned physicians here is very narrow. We had an interesting case in Australia over the last few days, Debbie. One of our free-to-air public broadcasters, SBS, ran a program called Jabbed, which was a documentary on vaccination and whether it should be done by people, what are the pros, what are the cons. It was advertised as being the journalist's journey over the last few years investigating pros and cons. And we saw that there were certain people listed as experts, and one could tell that that was going to be a bit biased, but we all expected that because it's a public broadcaster that there would have been a fairly even-handed treatment of the topic. But I watched the program last night, and I, like many other people, were just so disappointed. Of all of the experts they asked, there was not one that was not pro-vaccination. Of all of the parents that they put on, including some parents of vaccine-damaged children, for every, and there were only a few of them, every time there was an excuse, or the parents themselves certainly ended up being supporting vaccination, there was not one question from a person with genuine concerns about vaccination, the sort of concerns that many of the people who tune into your show have. There was not one question asked or answered. And then I actually tonight, while I was waiting for the show to come on, I actually had a look at their resource page, which I hadn't looked at before. And we actually saw on their resource page some of the skeptics' blog sites, Sense About Science and one of the other very common ones. Now, it's just mind-blowing that a public right. broadcaster would be so biased in the information they're giving out to parents. The only good thing I can say is that when one looked at the posts over the last 24 hours, many, many people have complained about the bias in the program. But I know that I put in a post and they wouldn't allow it to be aired, and it wasn't in any way offensive. It was just raising a few pointers, about the program. So this is what we're facing. It's very, very difficult when the mainstream media, even the ones that are not commercial medias, are so heavily influenced in the one direction.
Right. So you should have been one of those resources as an expert in this field, as many others who I call the whistleblowers, who put their lives on the line, put their jobs on the line. Many of them end up to be scapegoats, like Dr. Andrew Wakefield. They're dredging up his name and blaming him for an entire measles outbreak because of something 10 years ago, which was he was exonerated from that, and they still say he is to blame. And these are the kinds of things that will frighten an individual from speaking out. So it is censorship, like you said, that why weren't your posts allowed, which was quite innocuous, to just inform people about basic information. So we have to understand, and I guess people don't, not everybody recognize that there is a growing population of people who are learning that we are not free to speak out, or there are so many threats to us as we lose our civil rights, which is also happening in the vaccination area, as laws are being made to restrict our choices. So the mainstream media and supposedly the public broadcasting media, which is not supposed to be affiliated with any bias, has been twisted in this way. I think that people are probably interested in learning, as I promoted this show, about your article. I have written a little something. It's kind of long. If you don't mind, I will read something kind of spiritual. What do you think?
Good. I think that sounds lovely.
Okay. This is what I wrote the other day. Most of us have a cynical and skeptical streak when we hear something that sounds too good to be true. We may even be wired to have doubts and questions until our own senses and experience provide rock-solid evidence and validity. On the other hand, small miracles occur every day, which we may call circumstance, alignments in time and space, intuition, serendipity, and the like. We grow up hearing miraculous stories about heroes, about historical figures who go beyond the limits and the barriers put before them. These people forge ahead to accomplish the incomprehensible and attain world records. I recently read about this man who unintentionally fell from the sky to the earth. He was a skydiver. His name was Michael Holmes, and he had a split second to consider his demise when his parachute and his reserve parachute failed to open while he was jumping from a height of 2 miles up in New Zealand. He lived. The experience didn't dissuade him from desiring to continue skydiving. That was in December 2012. You can see his interviews on the Today Show and some more, actually see what happened, him falling on YouTube. A few brave souls felt that they could attain record dive into water from the incredible height of 172 feet up a ladder. And I'm going to put this on the homeopathic website, showing these young men who walk up a ladder. You cannot imagine. It's like you're in the circus, right? They go up to such a height, and they actually jump off into water. And I mean, these are things that are impossible. So people who tell us that homeopathy is not possible, you have to kind of expand your mind a little bit. And more recently, Steve Baumgartner, he achieved the highest fall or dive to Earth from outer space. Who would have thought this could be possible? And so some people will want to bet on the veracity and potential for any outcome based upon their own knowledge, advice from trusted friends, past experience, and perhaps whether they have a gene for risk-taking, and take a chance for the slimmest possibility of success. I mean, these people are really adventurous. As I was going on a walk yesterday, I was listening to the NPR show, and there was they're making the fastest computer and using quantum technology, and they're showing that the brains of the computer were completely different than the typical, what you think, the on-off switch, that there is this quantum, what's it called, quantum network, or quantum, maybe you know the word, quantum net. And anyway, so it means that the things that we don't think are possible can be possible. The element of faith plays a part in our acceptance of some stories we hear from friends, family, reporters, teachers, and heroes. On the occasion when we were told something happened that can only be attributed to coincidence, our thinking tells us the story must be totally implausible, perhaps because our rational, logical mind has not grasped the concept. Ask yourself, does our ego hold us back from believing? Do we need that magical numerical consensus, which some people call the tipping point, for us to go along with the majority? So this is the thing. The majority is getting one message from the mainstream media, and we're this tiny, small number of people that we need to reach out and get more people to listen to this information. Will we believe when society accepts or when friends, family, and neighbors tell us it's what they believe? We need to keep our framework, our skeptical mind, our thinking cap on to go about our day. Otherwise, we would be a pushover. We don't want to be taken advantage of, especially when we have purchased a product or service in the past that did not live up to all its claims. How many people have gone back and forth to the doctor because the first antibiotic didn't work, the second antibiotic didn't work, the third antibiotic? I hear it right now. People are having pneumonia, and these medicines are not working. What is going to trigger them and trip the wire for them to investigate changing something else? So in our world today, filled with corruption and lies and people trying to scam us, take our money, we must be cautious. But simply because a percentage of people will take advantage of us in our good desire to trust and believe does not mean to negate that our inner intuition and our longing from our heart or spirit center is where what we must follow. In fact, how many of us say, quote unquote, nothing happens by chance? I believe in a master plan, and I'm on the road and journey to expand my horizons. I will examine and test the declarations made by untrustworthy people. So take a look at the information and the facts of who's buying who and how many, what did you say, $40 billion
yeah.
is spent? $40 billion is spent to promote this information to you, the public. And in our case, talking about the medical field. On the other hand, when you can see with your own eyes the positive changes in a friend who has tried a healing modality such as homeopathy or even juicing, watch Chris Carr. She was diagnosed with cancer. The doctor said, well, you have such a rare cancer, we can't even do any surgery, chemo, or radiation. You're on your own. Prepare your death. And she said, no way. She went on a healing journey, and she's been juicing, and she's alive and out there talking about it. Your doubt will start to shift when you listen to these other voices. Someone who has already set in stone their belief system will only fixate more to defend their position, no matter what new information comes their way. And that's what we're talking to when we're talking to the skeptics. Maybe they're paid off, maybe they're not, but you're talking to the hand, you're talking to the wall, and it's not going to get you anywhere. If the staunch defender maintains the oppositional attitude, they will naturally degrade the messenger who brings information that does not fit neatly into their scope and range of believability. In these cases, their means of defense will be to defame a person's good and virtuous character, calling the messenger a liar or worse. However, the realm of spirit will constantly and continuously send us messages and messengers. The open-minded will tune in, become receptacles, while the information will bounce off of the non-believers. For those who want to be a receiver of truth, a lifelong goal of spiritual refinement to upgrade their character as a humble and passionate, compassionate human being will open the door to the miraculous. And that is my long-winded spiritual thoughts for today.
That's lovely. Can I be, and look, you know, I've, followed a spiritual path for 40 plus years. But my task these days, I see as putting that to one side in the sense of what I say publicly, and really focusing on providing reasonable, appropriate, and real world evidence of what we and our hearts know and what we've seen with our own eyes. You see, with complementary medicine, and I know we're mainly talking about homeopathy, but I'd like to expand it to complementary medicine in general, and I mean mainstream complementary medicine, herbal medicine, nutritional medicine, the standard naturopathic, homeopathic sort of approaches. We have an obligation to provide people with support so that when they see something happening and they want to find out, okay, is there some basis for this? Is there some evidence that what we've experienced is actually a genuine experience as opposed to an imagined one, or even a placebo response, and not that there's anything necessarily wrong with that in healing. I think the onus is on us to provide this evidence. And the thing is that we have, as a group of professions which follow the basic principles that we have a God-given self-healing, self-regulating mechanism, which we're all born with, and which, if it's allowed to work freely, will always tend to bring us back to a position of balance. And Hahnemann in the Organon emphasized this. He called it the vital force. The name doesn't matter. We can have debates about what Hahnemann's vital force really was. I have my own view, but it's different to other people's views. It doesn't matter. What we know is that when a person is allowed or given the opportunity to heal, and they remove as much as possible stresses and toxins from every level of their being, then most of the time they do heal. And even when a person may be at the end of their physical journey this life, I'll never forget, very early on in my practice, this probably would have been 26 or 27 years ago, I had a patient who had terminal stomach cancer, and he was probably in his mid-60s, I'd say, and he came in to see me and he said, look, I'm going to die, and I'm going to die fairly soon. I'm not asking you to try and stop that, but I am suffering pain and discomfort, and can you help me with that? And we talked and I gave him some remedies, and it really did help him in his last months in terms of his quality of life and comfort. But the thing I'll never forget, and I hope people will excuse a little bit of language here, but quoting him, he said to me, son, because I was 20 years younger than him at the time, or maybe a little more, he said, over my life, I've been a real bastard to people. I've treated people dreadfully, but since I've had the diagnosis, I've changed, and I've really become a much better person, a person who's decent to other people. Now, you see, even though someone like that, who's reached the end of their incarnation just about, and even though their physical body cannot be saved, something has healed. Something has progressed because he allowed, he opened his heart, he opened his mind, and the more important part of him, in a way, healed. And we see this all the time with people who are facing dreadful health decisions, that many of the people who, really embrace this opportunity and see it as an opportunity to make a change, they say themselves that they become better people. And that's a healing journey, which is just as important as removing a physical symptom which may be annoying. Unfortunately, in orthodox medicine, if someone has an annoying physical symptom, the first line of attack is to suppress it, and suppression drives the disease force deeper into the system and causes disturbances on a much, much deeper level. And we see this, and we see the evidence of this when healing occurs. So, for example, quite a few children with asthma, if you take their case and see that they started with eczema and the eczema was cured with cortisone cream, and then 6 or 12 months later they developed asthma. If the asthma is treated appropriately, the skin eruption will always come back. And it's not the remedies that are bringing it back. It's our self-healing wisdom that's bringing it back, because that will always try and externalize. You know, I had a very interesting patient today, because I did my clinic earlier on in the day, and she was a lady probably in about her mid-30s, and she came in with a skin rash, and she told me her history. She'd been on the IVF program. She has two children, but the second lot of IVF caused immense skin eruptions, which lasted for about a year. Now, that would have been about 20 months ago, because her youngest son is 20 months, or actually probably 26 months, because it started while she was pregnant. Now, she's been on for the last 18 months a concerted drive to try and clean herself out using, you know, a really, really good diet, to meditate, and to really take account of herself. And the skin eruption had gone away, and then all of a sudden it's come back. And, you know, I said to her, it's very likely, given that everything that she'd said, that this was actually her self-healing mechanism reaching a point where it could naturally start cleaning the body even further at even a deeper level, because everything else, her moods, her energy, the rest of the health was improving and was at an excellent level, but the skin was starting to play up. Now, the skin is the least important organ of the body, and it's the organ where the self-healing mechanism will always throw disease force, the residue, the dross in our system. The skin and the mucous membranes are usually the place where a really healthy system will get rid of waste. And so I told her, this is actually a very positive thing. You're reaching a new level of health where your own system has taken over, where it's not a matter of remedies doing it. Your actual self-healing system is doing it. This is what's missed in orthodox medicine, and it's what's known and appreciated in the best complementary medicine modalities, including homeopathy. These are things that people in Western societies so rarely hear in their education system, and people who become doctors rarely hear this. They don't understand that there's this innate inborn capacity to heal if it's given a chance to do its job. That's really the big difference between orthodox and complementary medicine. Now, you mentioned, you know, the fact that there's this this constant media pressure to follow the orthodox system. It is immense. I think that one of the best ways that we can teach other people is by our own example. It is important to get on to, you know, to write and to blog and to talk to people. But I think actually the best example is the way people live their lives and the results that come from that. Because when others see someone who is in really good natural health, they'll want to know why. And someone coming to ask and being told is much more receptive than someone just being told who really wasn't interested. And it's not just a matter of physical health. It's also a matter of emotional and intellectual health, as well as spiritual health. But let's just keep it to the three lower levels for the moment. Now, that's a very long-winded reply to your contribution, but I think these things are enormously important, because you see, there's no money in true preventative medicine. You talked about preventative medicine. There's no money for drug companies in preventative medicine. All it will do is save money. It'll save governments immense amounts of money. Now, I've been very interested, because my original training was in economics, in the economics of complementary medicine. I've been reading some articles recently, and they're talking about the American percentage of the health budget getting to around 26 to over 35%, depending on which set of assumptions. But even the lowest number, 26% of the American GDP by 2040, that would be almost ruinous. It's not sustainable. So we have something to offer and show people which is sustainable. And all I can say is, God willing, let's hope that the change, which inevitably will come sooner rather than later. Over to you.
Thank you very, very much for that answer. We must lead by our own example. And what boggles the mind is the thought that the economics, you would think that if the government and the people and the medical world wants to save money, wants to save people money, wants to see people healthy, that they would move in this direction of education toward the use of vitamins, which we are knowledgeable about, the use of herbs, the use of exercise and nutrition and all of these good things that are coming to light. You would think that that's where they would go, but for some reason it's not working out that way. And it's up to the people to make the movement change into this new direction based on what a person does in their own life, based on whether they buy organic or not, whether they tell somebody, hey, today's a march on Monsanto, and it was worldwide fantastic to participate and be part of this world energy. The other thing you mentioned was the emotional and spiritual health, mental health, and we see the outcome of the use of the drugs and the use of vaccines, that there is more violence as a repercussion, as a side effect, that I don't know whether it's listed in the literature, but we do see that this is what's happening. And even our own bodies are violently protesting when we are unable, when our gut health is so damaged that we can't even eat food without having pain, IBS, Crohn's disease, diverticulitis, or just allergic reactions to literally the minutest amount of particles in the air. Our bodies are having a revolution against what's going on. We have to listen to our bodies. I keep talk about just about anything, but I'm sure that the people want to hear about the beyond randomized controlled trials, evidence in complementary medicine. This article that you wrote, was it in 2011?
Yes. Yep.
And I'm sure that they want to hear something about that.
Right. In a way, it was an article I wrote for myself in my own journey of discovery. And the article by Professor Ioannidis in 2005 that I mentioned right at the beginning, why most research findings are false, I'd really recommend anyone who's got any interest at all in evidence-based to have a look at this. You know, it's technical, but it's not unreadable. So that was not the only influence. I mean, I'd been very concerned for a long time that trials of complementary medicines, and particularly homeopathy, which is in some ways probably the most difficult of all of the complementary medicines to trial, were often coming up short. But not because the medicine didn't work, but because the method of testing was totally inappropriate. There are various other authors out there who have been writing about this. I mean, this is not just one person's campaign in the orthodox literature looking at the shortcomings of randomized controlled trials, because you see, they're held up as the gold standard. Now, randomized controlled trials were originally designed to measure the toxicity of chemicals. And in some ways, they're very well suited for that, because whenever you're looking at a medicine, you're looking at, a medicine where a particular effect is being studied, like, say, for example, the removal of pain or the increased mobility of a joint. We have what are called specific and non-specific effects. So the specific effect is the, say, pain control, for example. In other words, a single effect, which is the focus of the study. Non-specific effects are everything else. Now, the one problem for complementary medicine is that you can have a fairly modest specific effect, but you can have a very significant non-specific effect, which is very positive. So in other words, the pain might be 70% better, but the person feels a whole lot better. And that's not captured at all in randomized controlled trials. So you could have two substances, say a drug and a complementary medicine. The drug may have a greater specific effect, but may have a significant negative impact, i.e. side effects, toxic side effects, on the person. Compared to the complementary medicine, where the specific effect is relatively smaller, but the non-specific effect is massively positive. And yet, because of the way that randomized controlled trials are studied and are set up, that would show the drug was a more effective treatment than the complementary medicine, even though the actual improvement in pain was relatively quite small, the difference between the two methods. But one had massive adverse side effects and the other one had significantly positive effects on the general mood, energy and well-being of the person. So you see, because of this structural flaw, and this was one of the things Ioannidis mentioned, but it's been mentioned by many, many other authors as well, this inherent structural flaw in randomized controlled trials means that they're not appropriate methods for really studying the true effectiveness of complementary medicines. We need to look at all measures, a whole range of methods of studying the effects of medicines, and really look at a combination of results and see if there's a consistency of findings. The other problem, the other, if you like, structural problem with randomized controlled trials is that there is a trade-off. It's an inevitable trade-off, whatever you're testing, whether it's a drug or a complementary medicine, between real-world relevance and, if you like, the statistical purity of the trial. So if you want to get a statistically perfect trial, you have to make so many assumptions that it makes the real-world relevance almost impossible. So, for example, a very simple example, in a randomized controlled trial, you have, if you like, an active group and a placebo group. That's the control. Now, in order for the trial to be a perfect trial, the two groups have to be perfectly matched. So in other words, sex, age, demographic, health before entering the trial, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It is almost impossible to get that in practice. And so you're starting from a base where automatically there is going to be less than perfect result. And so sometimes researchers go to extraordinary lengths to try and get matching as close as possible. But then we find that the populations being used don't reflect the general population of the wider community. So you may get two really well-matched groups of people for the trial, but when you look at their demographic and health profile compared to the general population, it doesn't really correspond. So the findings that you get, the more perfect the trial is statistically, the less relevant it can be my concern when I was writing this article was to try and make a comment about the relevance of randomized controlled trials in testing complementary medicines. I started off by making a very simple observation about the effectiveness of trials by pointing out how many times in the real world substances, drugs, which had passed randomized controlled trials were later on found to be quite dangerous and in many cases were withdrawn by the FDA in your country, by the TGA in my country, because of side effects which were not found during the trial. Now, whether or not they were not found because there was some intent to withhold data, and that's happened before, or whether it was just simply a flaw in the underlying methodology itself, it doesn't matter. But what that shows right from the start is that RCTs are not perfect because, you know, when something's held up to be a gold standard, it should be pretty close to being perfect. In other words, if it tells you something is safe and effective, it should be safe and effective. Well, we know, in fact, that that's not the case because of just looking at the real world. And we also can look at the people who are actually undertaking the trials. And this comes back to the Ioannidis's 2013 article. But I also mentioned this in my article in 2011, Integrity and Probity. When you look at the record of Big Pharma, and Big Pharma, by the way, are now sponsoring over 60% of all medical research, and the majority of that is being done by special companies, usually in third world countries or countries in the old Iron Curtain countries where corporate governance is very, very poor. When you find that most trials are being done in this situation, once again, our level of confidence in the result, in the people doing the work, is not high. Now, you know, there's been an enormous amount of study done and money spent on validating medicines. The amount, the cost involved in validating a new medicine is enormous. You know, you can talk about tens and in some cases hundreds of millions of dollars. So unfortunately, the incentive to get the result you want, in other words, to get a successful result, is enormous. And these things are pointed out by Ioannidis and others. Now, the other name that I'd just like to, I won't go on too much longer here, but the other name I'd like people just to write down is Professor Harold Wallach. So it's W-A-L-A-C-H. And he's a wonderful researcher in complementary medicine. And he's written a number of extremely good articles about other ways to collect data and evidence. And he uses what he calls, rather than a hierarchical approach that's used in orthodox medicine with the randomized controlled trials at the top and clinical evidence at the bottom, or anecdotal clinic evidence at the bottom, he talks about a circular approach where we look at lots and lots of different ways of examining the effect of medicines, and this can include interviews with patients outside of a formal structure. It can include the collection of clinical experience by experts in the field, right through to randomized trials or even non-randomized trials, which can also be very, very useful. So I looked at his work as well and saw the value in that. And then I ended up with seven steps, which I think people in orthodox medicine who are researching should consider. And I don't think it's probably appropriate now, and we are getting close to the end of the hour, to necessarily go through the whole seven. But if people are interested, they can certainly look at the article. It was published in the Journal of Evidence-Based Complementary and Alternative Medicine. So that was the Journal of Evidence-Based Complementary and Alternative Medicine. And look, you know, if people need a reference to it, Debbie, is there a Can it be put on your website, for example, for listeners to refer to in the next few days if there's an interest in looking at it further?
Right. I will upload the PDF file of this article to the announcement page for today's show. So people will be able to...
Hold on. Yeah, I don't know if you can actually do that because it is the property of the journal.
Oh.
So, yeah, you can't upload a file. Once an article's been published in a journal, it becomes the property of the journal. And
okay,
you can't
publish
it out with vision, but you can publish the reference to it.
Okay, I can publish the reference and maybe I can just talk about some of it.
You could publish the abstract.
Okay, I can publish the abstract. Okay, can do that.
You're certainly allowed to do that and the reference. What I might do, I might email you the reference to Professor Ioannidis' 2013 article, if you like, and you could put that up as well for people
Great.
Who want to have a look. Fantastic article, really is.
And, you know, this is an opportunity for anyone who is listening in today to either call in to 347-945-6956 or push the blue Skype button and talk with us if you have a question, or write in to the comment area on Blog Talk Radio. We have been extremely fortunate to have Dr. Golden with us, and it's up to him how much longer he would like to speak and if there's any other important information that we should know. It's possible that, Dr. Golden, it's very late for you, you might leave, and I might go ahead and talk a little bit further about what was the trigger for me to do today's show regarding the article about homeopathy is poison. So whatever you want to talk about in terms of the seven steps would be great. I know people are want to hear more about that.
Okay. Well, look, maybe I'll just talk briefly to it without going to it, you know, necessarily point by point, and then if you don't mind, I will. It's after midnight here, so
oh yeah,
yeah. And I've had a very long day in clinic, and I've got a busy day tomorrow, so
right.
I might say goodnight to everyone. But you know, basically, with the seven steps. Okay, look, let me just go through them very, very quickly. And for some people, you know, this won't be of great interest, but for those of you who are interested in collecting evidence, and certainly those of you who may be researchers already, these are some points to consider. So point one, study mainly complementary and alternative medicine interventions or medicines that are known from considerable experience to be effective. So in many forms, like herbal medicine, this can go back thousands of years. We know acupuncture, for example, has a very long history. Homeopathy has a history of 200 years, which is still considerable. So, by the way, what I was doing here was really trying to distill the suggestions from a range of authors, not just from one or two, but from a range of authors to, and the aim was to try and come up with a protocol which would give us the greatest chance of successfully producing or validating complementary medicines, and that includes homeopathy. So the purpose was to set up a structure that would maximize the likelihood of getting a successful result, not by fiddling the figures, but by having a structure, a research structure in place that had a good chance of succeeding, rather than slavishly using the structures that orthodox medicine say are the gold standard, which are totally inappropriate in most cases for complementary medicine. So that was point one. Two, use the largest sample sizes that can be afforded. And I mean, that's a pretty obvious one. Large outcome studies combined with economic cost-benefit analyses are ideal. And, you know, I actually really do feel that the answer for complementary medicine in general is going to come from health economists. Now, in our show last week, you very kindly noted my new appointment at Ballarat University in Australia here as an honorary research fellow in the School of Science, Information Technology and Engineering. And the reason I'm so excited about this is that I've only visited the university once since that appointment, but already I've met about four people who I will be very interested in working with. I'm going to be meeting on my next visit a health economist who's done a lot of work in Australia, because I actually really believe that eventually politicians will be forced to listen to health economists as the budget dries up, as the availability of funds dry up to run our expensive health systems. Politicians will listen to people who come forward with evidence-based suggestions of how we can do something different. Anyway, that's point two. Point three, research those interventions or medicines with a significant effect size before studying those with low or uncertain levels of effectiveness. So what that's saying is that it's not just a matter of using ones that we know have some beneficial effect. It's using ones which we know have a clear, an unambiguous beneficial effect. So rather than being slightly better than doing nothing, they're significantly better than doing nothing, because this will mean that it'll be a much easier job to validate the level of effectiveness than if the benefit of the medicine is marginal. Four, study an intervention or medicine using a variety of research methods. This should include outcome comparisons between pharmaceutical and complementary and alternative medicine interventions for particular conditions. And this is a very important thing. Rather than base everything as a study between a medicine and placebo, studying the effects of an orthodox medicine versus a complementary medicine to treat a particular condition gives us, in many cases, much more accurate and reliable and real-world value results. And I think that more and more studies are doing this in orthodox medicine as well as in complementary medicine. I think that's a very useful thing. Evaluate the intervention medicine based on the totality of evidence available, not just individual studies. So it is true that one study will never prove anything. Like some of the research I've published, on its own it proves nothing. But when you combine it with all the other studies which have looked at the same thing in that field, then when you combine studies, you get a very strong, meaningful result. Now, orthodox medicine does this already using meta-analyses, and it's totally appropriate for us to use meta-analyses, but they don't all just have to be of RCTs alone. They can be of varying research methods. Six, focus on studies testing an established intervention or medicine in preference to new interventions or medicine. That's an extension of the first point. And finally, publish and consider all studies, whether they support or reject the hypothesis. And this is very important, because we know that, to be honest, many research findings have not been published because they haven't suited the people who have paid for them. And then in that article, I actually applied those seven steps or seven factors to testing the effectiveness and safety of homeopathic immunisation or homeoprophylaxis. And just finally, to run through very quickly, Debbie, what I found there. So point one, study pre-study odds of a positive effect. Homeoprophylaxis has been used successfully since 1798. Therefore, we know that it is a medicine which is effective. So that's the first point. Second point, sample sizes. Well, my samples have been over a couple of thousand. Moroninsky and others in Brazil looked at over 80,000. But the Finlay Institute has now looked at over 2.2 million with leptospirosis, 9.8 million when it came to swine flu, and the Indian intervention against Japanese encephalitis in Andhra Pradesh province looked at around 20 million. So we now have very, very significant sample sizes, and certainly big enough to produce legitimate and meaningful effects. Point number three, the effect size. So studies suggest a 90% effectiveness of homeoprophylaxis. So that's certainly a strong effect size and is and makes it totally relevant for this sort of profile. Four, variety of methods. We've looked at, there was only been one clinical trial, I think, which was a very poor result, but we've looked at prospective and retrospective cohort studies, questionnaire studies, descriptive studies, as well as two centuries of recorded clinical experience. The Moroninsky study in Brazil is probably the closest we've got to a it wasn't a randomized controlled trial, but there was definitely a cohort. So it was a controlled trial. But the point was that all of these different methods, which have been used to test different homeoprophylaxis medicines over 200 years, all came with consistent results. And that was what's really important. Totality of studies. So we have four types of evidence. Firstly, 200 years of clinical experience. Secondly, short-term epidemic studies. Thirdly, long-term endemic studies. And fourthly, provincial and national studies. And once again, when you look at all of the findings from all of these different types of studies, consistency is coming through. Six, test-established methods. So homeoprophylaxis, as I said earlier, is a well-established part of homeopathy based on the principle of similars. And seven, publish all studies. Now, certainly in what I've published everything I've been able to find in English. There certainly have been other studies not in English that I haven't had access to. So what I tried to do in the article was to, based on the information or the wisdom of the people I was looking at, come up with a set of seven basic characteristics that were needed to produce meaningful research studies of safety and effectiveness of complementary medicines. And then when I used the little case example of homeoprophylaxis, we could see that it ticked all the boxes. So even though we time and again have orthodox people saying, for example, there's no evidence supporting homeopathic immunization, or there's no evidence supporting homeopathy, it's just simply untrue. The evidence is not what they would like to see in terms of their paradigm, but their paradigm is totally inappropriate for testing complementary medicine. And that's really the point of the article and the point of, you know, what I was trying to contribute tonight.
Wonderful. This has been so clear, and I know people will take this message away and repeat to their friends and their colleagues how we must look at making it more structured in this way to take in a lot more information. And I think that even the medical professionals are doing it when they go home and they say, you know, use some vitamins or use some herbs or use the neti pot or these types of things. They're, when their patients come in and say, this is what is working for me for my sinus infection, and they get so much of it that they're now taking the message from the patient to tell their other patients. Because, you know, this is when it's true, and when we see it, they're going to want to help their own patients with it. So I thank you so much for putting this all together into a nice succinct paper and explaining it to us. I think more people will be listening and speaking out. This is a time where people are desperate. They're finding that the more medicines that they take, the weaker their vital force, the less they are able to ward off illness. And then we're finding that people who are taking these complementary and integrative medicines, once they get started on this road, many of the things that didn't work begin to work even more effectively. So that's another thing that I have found, that people who tell me that the herbs that they were taking stopped working, and then they get a homeopathic remedy, and they go back to taking the herb, all of a sudden, it's much more effective. So that's an interesting little piece of information as well. So I want to wish you a fantastic weekend, great day, or you've already started. You're on the next week because you're You're on Monday. I'm on Sunday. So I want to thank you so much for taking your valuable time with us. And I'm going to continue to talk to the listeners, whoever's out there, about some more information. I want to thank those. Okay?
Yeah, thank you very much. And I won't say good night to all your listeners because I know it is the morning. It's just become Tuesday here. So we really are ahead. So I look forward to talking to you and to your wonderful listeners again sometime in the future. And thank you. Good night. Bye-bye.
Awesome. Bye-bye. And for those folks who are still listening in with me, I'm going to talk a little bit more about what it was that triggered this talk today with Dr. Golden. You know, he's been on the show about three or four times, and he was just on the Health In show last Monday. To have him back twice in a row is quite unusual. I like to mix it up and have a whole variety of experts in health. So I'm going to just talk a little bit about an article that I saw and what was said to me by Sandra Herman, who is a member of Homeopathy World Community. She said, "Debbie, did you see this article that's called Homeopathic Medicine Contains Poison?" And so you kind of wonder why a person would title it so strongly to try and get a rise out of people. This was posted in Forbes Online, which is a major broadcast system, in March of 2013 by Steven Salzberg, a professor of medicine and biostatistics in the Institute of Genetic Medicine at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. So, you know, we have recently gone through the industrial age, we have gone through the antibiotic era, which is now failing us, and we have entered into the genetic age of medicine, where every single thing is being tested, every single potential possibility of dysfunction, disease, labeling. They want to target you as a guinea pig or as a purchaser of another vaccination. And when they do that, they don't realize the effects, the total effects on your immune system. They just want to see a response effect at the micro level. They don't want to see your healing effect at the macro level holistically. And so you can see where he potentially has a bias if he's working in genetic engineering. And his byline also proves that he has a bias. It's called fighting pseudoscience. And what is his definition of pseudoscience? Do we know? It is not surprising that he would not be pro-homeopathy in any way, even though many medical people in the medical field are now using the simple remedy Arnica for injury or for after surgery. People are using it more and more, and the general population is learning about these kinds of homeopathic remedies, although they might mislabel it and call it herbal or herbal medicine. They don't realize how much of a quantum level of energy medicine it is. Always put on your thinking cap when you read these articles. Put on your little skeptical way of looking at it and think about, you know, they're going to attack you back. They're going to degrade you. They're going to do name calling of anything that you write. But the difference is, why would you continue to do that and post in the comment area? Because there are other people who are up there reading this stuff. And if they don't hear the other side of the message, then they're going to miss out on what you have to teach them. So we have to be educators and informants of the practices that we use. So the author said that homeopathy was based upon a 1938 law that the homeopathic remedies contained in the federal homeopathic pharmacopoeia were declared drugs, and thus they fell under the jurisdiction of the FDA. A special caveat was added in this law, stating that due to the nature of these highly dilute substances, the majority of remedies were deemed safe and can be sold over the counter. And the reason for this is one of the things that the detractors say and the skeptics say is there's nothing in it. It's diluted like a drop in the ocean. So it's totally ineffective and it can't do anything to the body because these so-called energy medicines, it's not even plausible that they could have an effect. And so they're kind of working both sides of the fence. Does it have an effect? Is it poison? Or is there nothing in it? They have to make up their mind. They're trying to straddle both sides of the issue and dissuade you from even trying homeopathy based on their own perspectives. The political lobbying and conflict of interest in the drug industry is obvious, which was just discussed about the $40 million, probably way, way more. And the amount of conflict of interest and bribery, we know just on this week, Monsanto rules the world, their monopoly, and the amount of money that they spend on their industry and promoting their products is incredible. So there's no question that there's a problem going on. And who is doing the research? Mr. Salzberg notes that the aggressive lobbying efforts, he says, he tries to turn the tables around. He says it's the lobbying efforts of homeopaths during the era of 1938 that allowed homeopaths to maintain the list of remedies. But we know that we have a very small minority of people working in homeopathic industry. We do not have a great amount of funding. We need your funding. We need your support in every way that you can. Join the National Center for Homeopathy or whatever organization is in your country. Support them. Purchase their journals. Follow their information and comment on their websites. It's really so much support if you just comment and share this information. He concludes that there exists a conflict of interest, and it's laughable. The conflict may arise when an individual or organization involved in multiple interests that can possibly corrupt an act due to impure motivations, as in bribery or possibility of gain. Who can gain the most? The drug industry can gain the most. Homeopaths from around the world are experts in the field in both gathering data, recognizing and having volunteer patients initially prove new remedies, validating time-honored remedies. So there are homeopaths that are going back and reproving, doing clinical trials of the oldest remedies that have the polycrest that have been used for 200 years, because there's always new information coming out about that. Whereas in allopathic medicine, the medicines are being taken off the shelves simply due to the harmful effects, even death. And, you know, we all hear it. Are we blind? Are we deaf? Do we put the blind, deaf, and dumb on our senses when we read the commercials that say, seizures and death can be an outcome of taking this medicine? Speak to your doctor. Homeopaths treat their patients to confirm the use of these remedies for a total symptom picture. And they publish journal articles and share their knowledge at conferences and seminars around the world. Conventional mainstream medicine does not validate the drugs in the same manner. And that's what Dr. Golden was saying, that they have a very narrow purview of what is allowable to be discussed and considered validation. And I also want to direct you to Lionel Milgram, who has posted numerous articles and papers talking about randomized controlled trials and scientism. Rather, they depend upon affiliate research trials. They're paying for their own research. Is that a conflict of interest? And, you know, when something is published, people are supposed to post. They have a conflict of interest somewhere along the line. Just because they say that they do and they acknowledge it and they post it in their publication, does that mean that it's okay? Or should they withdraw themselves from being a participant in possible bias and prejudice? Is it wrong that they are being paid to do these studies? Is the research outcome manipulated in some way? Are the total results being disclosed? That's a big question we might have. We haven't even touched upon, recalled. We did touch upon recalled drugs. And in 200 years and plus of homeopathic remedies and the foundation of homeopathy, we've never really had one recall. We haven't had side effects to the extent of allopathic medicine. So it's all bogus what they say. Take it with a grain of salt. What about the cost of drugs are too high? Mr. Salzberg does not address the cost to approve new mainstream drugs when compared to homeopathic remedies. Forbes ran an article in 2012 about the staggering cost. Quote, the average drug developed by a major pharmaceutical company cost at least $4 billion. It can be as high as $11 billion. Who has the funds to develop a new drug? It is not difficult to imagine how corruption in the form of gifts and favors could easily seep into this kind of a system of production of drugs. And then we talk about innocent until proven guilty, or you can't disprove a theory without all the information. No one can say with certainty that the hypothesis about the nature of homeopathic remedies has been proven false without a review of recent studies and the exhaustive patient histories of provings and cures that we can read in our repertories, in our Materia Medica, that have been collected over 200 years. These are totally pushed aside and excluded because they don't fit into the narrow parameters that they want you to put into a petri dish of randomized controlled trials. Hahnemann was not the only person who believed in the similimum, in the theory of likes cures likes. And there's a lot that you can do research about that. The use of homeopathic principles in conventional medicine, without stating the obvious, researchers are only recently starting to believe in the wisdom and foresight of Hahnemann's use of the minimum dose to lessen the body's burden when it attempts to restore to equilibrium. Back to balance is what Dr. Golden said. From the aggressive onslaught by drugs to change the body's chemistry by force, by crude drugs, by changing a person's hormones, which often leads to adverse long-term damage. Drug researchers are discovering that by reducing the amount of a drug given to a patient, better results will occur with less side effects. So they're even proving the Hahnemann's homeopathic wisdom of the minimum dose and likes cures likes. The adverse side effects have not been totally eliminated, but reduced. And we're going to be able to see that if you do your own research on the use of estrogen. I also want to direct you to just look up Sandra Herman Courtney, and all of the comments that she posted, because she's a warrior. She's out there fighting for homeopathy, and more people who do that, the more show of support will be there on the networks. There's new research on homeopathy, too. A new research study shows that homeopathic treatment reduces the painkiller usage by 50%. Now, that's quite significant. The study of 1,151 patients included people suffering from osteoarthritis, rheumatism, fibromyalgia, muscle spasms, tendonitis, rotary cuff syndrome, ankylosis spondylitis, intervertebral disc disorders, neck pain, torticollis, spinal stenosis. You know, all of these types of long-term chronic illness cause incredible functional disorder and pain for people that they have to constantly be taking drugs. What if using homeopathy, meditation, breathing, Reiki, and all these other things, they could reduce their need for drugs by 50%? That's good news, considering that painkillers can cause serious side effects. Homeopathic treatment can restore your health and prevent serious illness. In healthcare finance news, we have a report that states after recent criminal and civil fines in the amount of $422.5 million that was imposed upon pharmaceutical company Novartis in 2010, it seems a better choice to take precautionary measures because they're going to be fined for promoting their drugs, and they're going to continue to promote their drugs because they're going to make the cost-benefit ratio to them. Okay, so it's like getting a ticket and paying your fine, but you continue to speed. You continue to take your drugs because they're addicted to their money. Classical healers have known the basic principle of likes cures like throughout history. Hippocrates in 460 to 350 BC, he was regarded as the father of medicine, who authored the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm, wrote, quote, by similar things a disease is produced, and through the application of like is cured, unquote. Aristotle, in 384 to 322 BC, knew the principle as well and wrote, quote, often the simile acts upon the simile, unquote. Or as Dr. Samuel Hahnemann said, likes cures likes. In Latin, it's milia similibus centur, curentur. Monsanto spent nearly $6 million lobbying, and their payoff was, guess what? The Monsanto Protection Act, which was written anonymously, passed in secret, and allows Monsanto to keep selling genetically engineered seeds, even if a federal court says that they may pose a health risk. So you're not hearing about the health risks. They're totally protected, and it's in covert action. It's in secret. That's why we, as the general population, as we learn about this information, must speak out. So I encourage you to be a participant in all of these worldwide events. And I've got links to all of these things on Homeopathy World Community. Dr. Nancy Malik, who is one of my heroes, says, the application of the law of similars is found in chemistry and immunology. For example, a basic principle of solvent chemistry states that a substance will be a solvent to another substance when it has a similar type of molecular bond. It has to be either similarly polar or similarly apolar, and then like will dissolve like. Immunology applies the law of similars to activate antibody responses with small doses of similar substance that will evoke the allergic symptoms. The law of similar in conventional medicine. Here we go. And these are big words. These are medical terms. Dexafetamine and methylphenidate hydrochloride are amphetamines. We know these drugs. We call them Ritalin. They're psychostimulants. They're a substance that would normally cause hyperactivity. And these are chemically identical to cocaine. We give them to our children in massive doses. Conventional medicine gives this stimulant to treat hyperactive children. Is this not likes cures likes? Or at least they're using it in crude substance to do such a thing? Conventionally, it has never been explained why stimulants should calm an already overstimulated child. But this is what happens. What about radiation? We use radiation to treat people with cancer. But Madame Curie, who contracted cancer because she was playing around and investigating with radiation, caused her cancer. The vaccines in conventional medicine are derived from the law of similars, with few differences, are they not? They are trying to take the disease substance and inject it into your body to cause an immune response so that you will be resistant to that disease. The unfortunate part about vaccinations today, they are created with so many adjuvants, so many heavy metals, MSG, polysorbate, other cancer-causing agents and that cause neurological damage, that they're doing more than just shaking up your immune system. They are really damaging it. What about anti-venoms that are used for snake bites, that are used from snake venom? I can't tell you how much conventional medicine uses the principle of likes cures likes. And I have a link on the website on Homeopathy World Community about a discussion from Dr. Luke about the law of similars. You can take a look at that. And there's also the FDA regulations on homeopathic remedies and the FDA website, which talks about the conditions under which homeopathic drugs may be used. So there's a lot more to this. Homeopathic ideas, like I told you, were used by Hippocrates and Paracelsus in 1493 to 1541 BC, way before the years of Samuel Hahnemann. Hahnemann just rediscovered it. He did not, as the attackers claim, he did not invent it. He did not make it up. He just rediscovered what was already there. And Dr. Hahnemann, kind of gave structure to it, gave it a name, laid out the principles in the late 18th century. Basil Valentine, a pseudonym of the Benedictine monk, believed to have lived in 14 BC, also wrote, quote, "Likes must be cured by means of their likes, and not by their contraries, as heat by heat, cold by cold, shooting by shooting. For one heat attracts the other to itself, one cold the other, as the magnet does the iron. Hence, pricking simply can remove disease, whose characteristic is prickling pains, and poisonous minerals can cure and destroy symptoms by poisoning when they are brought to bear upon them. And although sometimes a chill may be removed and suppressed, still I say, as a philosopher and one experienced in nature's way, that similar must be fitted with its similar, whereby it will be removed radically and thoroughly," what Hahnemann likes to say, annihilated. "If I am a proper physician and understand medicine, he who does not attend to this is no true physician and cannot boast of his knowledge of medicine, because he is unable to distinguish betwixt cold and warmth, betwixt dry and humid. For knowledge and experience, together with a fundamental observation of nature, constitute the perfect physician," unquote, by Basil Valentine de Microcosmo, which was way back in 1410 BC, for the Common Era, way before the time of Hahnemann, this theory was in place. Theophrastus von Hohenheim, commonly known as Paracelsus, flourished in the 16th century, and he said, quote, "What makes jaundice that also cures jaundice and all its species? In like manner, the medicine that shall cure paralysis must proceed from that which it causes. And in this way, we practice according to the method of cure by arcana," unquote. And this can be found on a page of Morell, Clark, and Dungeon, Let me see if I can find exactly where that link is. It is on the website spaceinmotion.com under Truth and Reality and Homeopathy if you want to look that up. We also have breaking news from Sue Young, historian. We give her so much credit. Every day she is doing her research into the lives of people throughout history. And she has done research about the German physician Robert Koch, who lived in 1843 to 1910, and who is honored as the father of microbiology and the man who promoted the germ warfare theory. Actually understood that only through the use of, quote, attenuated viruses could a vaccination be given safely. Really? Dr. Koch, the father of microbiology, said you cannot give a crude dose of a virus. You must use a homeopathic dose in order for it to be given safely. The medical community did not understand or want to believe in the minimum dose or allow homeopathy to flourish during his time and onward. Unfortunately, the great rift and war between Louis Pasteur and Robert Koch led to harmful effects. And, as Harris Coulter indicates, quite violent behavior in those who are vaccinated. So you can see those persons who are vaccinated end up with emotional mental disorders. Less is more. Let's take a look at the drugs that we use today for PMS, premenstrual symptoms, and hormones in the use of estrogen and progesterone. Over the years, the past five decades, when they started the use of these hormone treatments, they have reduced the amount of estrogen and progesterone in the therapies because an increase of estrogen dosage deteriorates mood. This is a published article called "During Progesterone Phase in Sequential Hormonal Therapy." Quote, since the 1930s, it's been known that high doses of the female hormone estrogen and progesterone will block ovulation, making conception impossible. This knowledge was employed clinically to create the first birth control pills. Oh, by the way, we know that this is one of the questions that's asked if you have been diagnosed with cancer. Did you take a birth control pill? Why? Because we know that that is one of the factors contributes to cancer. It will block ovulation, making conception impossible. This knowledge was employed clinically to create the first birth control pills consisting of high doses of estrogen and high doses of progestin. But there were some problems. This is reported on Brookside Press. High doses of estrogen are associated with unacceptably high frequency of unpleasant side effects, such as, and anybody who's taken these drugs knows, breast tenderness, nausea, headache, fluid retention, and mood changes. You know, a lot of these vaccines and whatnot, the mood changes and the antidepressants, the mood changes include suicidal tendencies, suicidal thoughts. Think about that. That's one way to reduce population. High doses were also found to be associated with more serious problems. Physical problems such as venous thrombosis and pulmonary embolism. So you're kind of trading one problem for another. You might be reducing the discomforts of the PMS, but instead you're going to have some kind of a stroke or a heart attack, or you're going to die from another cause. Further studies show that it took only moderate doses of progestin to block ovulation, and high doses of estrogen proved unnecessary. So we have been able to move away from the high-dose birth control pills of the 1960s and into the low-dose pills of the 1970s and beyond. Let's talk about that concept. I see somebody here is chatting. Thank you, Shelley, Family Tree Girl. I believe the pill also consistently causes fibroids. Thank you for contributing to the conversation. I really appreciate it. There's about 15 minutes left to today's show. I'll continue on and finish up. You know, they called homeopathic medicine, complementary and alternative, and integrative medicine, they call it snake oil. Who's calling the kettle black? You know, snake oil, what they're trying to do is put a picture in your mind of those practices of old-timey snake oil medicine that were trying to be scams. I see we also have a caller, but if you hold on for a minute, I want to talk about the snake oil. Using black mamba venom to heal. It is being said that mamba venom is more powerful pain reliever than the opiate derivative morphine, which has side effects. This is posted in October 2012. Let me see what kind of journal this is, if you hold on one second. Okay, this was part of a national report. So scientists have used the venom of Africa's lethal black mamba to produce a surprising outcome in mice, which they hope to replicate in humans, effective pain relief without toxic side effects. French researchers wrote in the journal Nature that peptides isolated from black mamba venom may be safer pain killer than morphine. And I want you to realize that a lot of these researchers, their intent is to find more and more drugs rather than using homeopathic remedies. Quote, we have identified new natural peptides, mambalgins, from the venom of snake black mamba to reduce pain. And this was in the National Research Institute. I have a whole bunch more on the use of phase two clinical trials using snake venom to stop acute heart failure. The list goes on and on to reduce blood clots, because we know that snake venom produces the epistasis. It produces bleeding and so many other things. And the use of rattlesnake for healing, and the use of this as a chemotherapy drug. Okay, I'm going to let the caller in now. Hello, caller.
Oh, hi. I was just listening.
Hello. Talk a little bit louder.
I'm just listening to your show.
Okay. Can we have your name? Oh, you're just listening. You didn't want to talk.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. And for those folks who just want to listen in, there is a way on the website to just click the show and push play. So, but a lot of people do, I notice, they do call in order to listen. So thank you so much. If there are any other comments about this topic, we will appreciate your feedback. You can share all of our archives on Blog Talk Radio and on the Health In Show. We appreciate that to get the word out to more and more people. We also have on Thursdays on Blog Talk Radio at 1 p.m. on Eastern Time every week, we have Alan Phillips talking about the legalities of our system, the legalities of exemptions and waivers for taking vaccinations, and what it means in society today if a pandemic, a worldwide pandemic, is announced. In that case, where you lose all of your rights and you might have to be quarantined and put into something like a concentration camp, or ways, what do you need to put into place to protect yourself and your family? I also want to make an announcement about next week's show, June 3rd. We're going to have Phyllis Georgic, Getting Back to Health Naturally. She's going to be on the Health In Show Monday, which is on the Nissan Communications Network normally. This is just a change in schedule due to Memorial Day that we're on Blog Talk Radio. On June 10th, we're going to have Dana Trentini, who calls herself the Thyroid Lady. She is a specialist in this area. And you know what? So many people who have gone through their own personal healing journey, they have been diagnosed with some sort of disease. They begin to investigate alternative methods of healing. They begin to investigate what the mainstream medicine and the medical community tells them to do, and whether you need to have aggressive treatment or whether you have time to take steps and do things on your own. Is there a way that you can cleanse your body and reduce stress in your life? That's one of the things I really love to talk about, reducing stress, taking time out, giving yourself some nurturing. You know, most of us are women who are caring for our families and looking for solutions. We are in charge of the what we buy in the store in terms of food. Are you buying processed food? Are you buying lots of junk food? Or have you switched over and tried to help heal your children at a young age and give them that immune support from the get-go? Or are you checking into which are the dirty dozen of foods that have tons of pesticides that have been genetically changed with Monsanto's GMO, genetically engineered seeds? Because when we eat it, we're changing our DNA. When we eat the pesticides and insecticides, which kill the insects, what are we killing in ourselves? You have to ask yourself these questions. What is safe without going nuts? Do it a little at a time. Do one little thing at a time. Search out, purchase locally, find out what your neighbors are doing. Start a little co-op. I did that recently. One of my friends goes every weekend to the farmer's market and buys organic kale and fennel and beets and other fruits and vegetables, and she's buying double and bringing it to me so that I just pay her. I save my time and I trust her to buy it for me. What other ways can we do this? I'm juicing. This is a really big thing. If you haven't gotten into it, that's something that I really highly recommend. Start your day with a fresh juice to cleanse your system. And your kids will love it. Introduce it to them perhaps with lots more apples and pineapple, something that they're going to enjoy the taste, and then introduce the greens into it, the kale. It's really tasty, and you know, then they'll tell their friends, let's start the trend for cleansing. A lot of people say it's too hard to change. One of the great ways of changing is just adding one new thing to your plan, to your routine. By adding one new thing, you're obviously filling a space where you might have been doing something else. You'll feel more satisfied with that juice so that you're not drinking perhaps the orange juice that has been washed in some kind of chlorine or something else. Then you're filling that space with something good. And as you do that, you're not going to feel a need. Your body's going to awaken to that brilliance, and you're not going to feel that need to have more salty, more sugary, more processed foods. So I highly recommend that as a way to go. Phyllis Georgic in her last show was teaching us how to start your own little garden. Do it in a pot if you live in an apartment. Join with your neighbors to do it together, because your harvest will be so great from your one little tomato plant that if you don't can, when the time of harvesting comes, you can share it with your friends. Maybe one friend will plant the cucumber, another will plant the squash, another will plant the tomato, and you can all share and enjoy meals together. These are, you know, bringing people together and having mealtime together is joyous. It's stress reducing. It's really helping your whole community and your family to have better relationships. So these are the things that I'd like to recommend. Finding 10 minutes to go, probably just start walking. If it's just a short amount of space that you can, distance that you can travel because you do have fibromyalgia or osteoarthritis or some kind of rheumatism or pain, just go a little distance or just move in place. Don't sit still. Just move your body and do some deep breathing. There's lots of things that you can do. And we have about 5 minutes left to the show, so let's just take that time to meditate on positive thoughts, not always thinking, getting away from too much news, which is something that I have a problem with. Personally, I see all the news and I want to read more and more about it to educate myself, but I also realize we have to find space to just sit in the sun, lay out and feel the breeze, get the sun's rays, listen to gentle music, something that will soothe the soul. Just get in touch with your body just at this very moment. How do you feel? Are you anxious? And if you are, what can you tell yourself to relax? Putting your feet flat on the ground or standing in a more solid manner. People are telling us to remove our shoes and have our bare feet touch the ground. There's even a movement one day out of the year to do this, to barefoot walking. Let your feet tickle the grass. And you know, we are electricity. We are connected to the magnet of the poles of this earth. Let our souls and our body align. This is actual science. This is fact. We are connected to the universe in this way. So do you feel that energy as you remove your shoes if you can, or if you are just putting your feet flat on the ground, letting your shoulders relax, and keeping your spine tall and lengthened, feeling the energy flow from the top of your head down through your spine into your body and into the earth, and just breathe with it. Breathe deeply and exhale any stress. Exhale any discomfort, concerns, worries, pain. Just allow your body to release any toxicity. This is what Dr. Golden was talking about, allowing your body to heal itself. Do we give ourselves enough chance to do that? Do we give ourselves the time instead of rushing off to the doctor immediately? Just think about that. What can we do to get in touch with our innate healing self? Do you feel your muscles relax? When you're feeling stressed, go into a self-meditation. Go into the quiet, into the silence, into the dark space. And when you go there and when you come out of that space, the world will be a lot brighter, more colorful, more beautiful place. I want to thank everybody for listening to me today for 2 hours, if you've hung in with me. These archives are available. You can take the widget and post this show onto your blog. You can post this show onto your website. And I want to thank you so, so much for being with me. If I have any music, if I find any music, I would love to play it. Let me see if I have anything here. Yes, I do. I'm going to just send us out with some music. Thank you so, so much for being part of our show today.
across this land, both near and far, throughout the human race, within each beating heart, there is a dream whose time has come for us to claim our birthright, each and every one. Evil hands have intervened, controlling from the shadows, think they can't be seen. But we have eyes, see in the dark, to cast a light upon the madness we embark. Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one trade your soul for dollars, dirty hands. Demand the truth, transparency. For we must be the masters of our destiny. Upon their face, sincerity, while underneath the self-agenda does proceed. But falsity perfumes the air, the sin screams louder than the finest debonair. They'll fill your place with GMOs, and soon your lineage will never cease to grow. Inject your blood with toxic waste. The world is all that bears if you'll just die in haste. Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one trade your soul for dollars, dirty hands. Demand the truth, transparency. For we must be the masters of our destiny. Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one trade your soul for dollars, dirty hands. Demand the truth, transparency. For we must be the masters of our destiny. For we must be the masters of our destiny. For we must be the masters of our destiny. Oh.